The first case this morning is Feldman v. Commissioner of Internal Revenue, Mr. Dahlman.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning, Counsel.
If it please the Court, Robert E. Dahlman, representing the appellants, who we call the shareholders. The issue is this. When one person can be liable for the debts of another person. The predominant transaction, the predominant aspect of the transaction was a stock sale. Okay. Time permitting, I would like to discuss two general points. One, why the tax court should be reversed without a remand, and then certain standard review points, please. I'll discuss, and there's another subset of categories of issues. There's legal and there's factual. I will discuss the legal issues first, please. There's two, as we keep going in this maze, there's two legal issues, if you will, and I'll discuss those first. Based on truly a fair reading of the controlling case in this area, U.S. Supreme Court case by the name of Stern, there are two independent tests that the IRS must satisfy. There's what's called in the trade a federal test, and then there's a state law test. The IRS must prevail on both tests, both the federal test and the state test. Not just one of them, both of them. The state tests are two federal Transfer Act statutes, Wisconsin, and then a Wisconsin corporate dissolution statute. As far as the federal test, it's 6901 of the Internal Revenue Code, and more specifically, 6901H. The burden of proof, uncontested, is on the IRS. On all these issues, I note that for the two federal state Transfer Act cases or statutes, there's a high burden, a clearly convincing burden, which the tax court agreed with and the various courts have agreed with.
Actually, I think the more focused question is how the federal question under 6901 relates to the state substantive law question, which is to say, what is the correct interpretation of the Stern case? That there's a threshold federal question about transferee status?
Yes.
And then how the resolution of that question relates to the question of substantive liability under state law?
Yes.
I mean, they're independent, but they're really not independent.
And we say they're independent, Your Honor. And
what's the point of the federal question, then, if they're independent? Is that just a pointless exercise on the part of the court?
No. The federal question is extremely important. I think some legislative history, which is mentioned in Stern, maybe in Sawyer, which is a First Circuit Court of Appeals case, and then Starnes, a Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals case, may back me up on this. But 6901 is there's two predecessors, if you will. Whether it's one predecessor or two, it doesn't matter. So your point is, if you would hold for the taxpayer in this situation, what is the significance of 6901? I hope that's your question, but in any event, that is one of the government arguments, and it's our point that if the IRS would satisfy the federal test, namely 6901, namely that these selling shareholders are transferees, namely that there is an in substance a liquidation of this corporation Woodside, that if the IRS satisfies that federal question, namely that there's a transfer, should the definition of transfer as determined by, hypothetically now, as determined by 6901, should that control for purposes of defining whether there's a transfer for state law purposes? Is that, Your Honor, is that the issue you're
That's
talking about?
Question,
because that
how,
is clearly.
How the threshold, everybody agrees that the determination of transferee status under 6901 is a federal law question. That has to be the case because there's a definition in the statute.
Right.
So what is the import of that determination for the next step in the analysis, which is the state law substantive liability question? If it's meaningless, you have to tell me why.
It's not meaningless. What the legislative history said to 6901 or its predecessor is 6901 was created or enacted to provide the IRS very meaningful rights. Prior to the predecessor of 6901, the IRS, if they wanted to sue or commence action against transferees, they had to go through all these cumbersome, and to the IRS attorney, and I used to be an IRS attorney, confusing state laws as far as how you sue a transferee. So what 6901 did, as defined, as described and confirmed by Stern, is that what 6901 or the predecessor did is they created a federal procedural statute as far as how in one clear way the IRS could move against transferees or alleged transferees. And the IRS could do it if they wanted to in the United States Tax Court. And the typical approach to getting to the tax court is the IRS sends out what's called traditionally a 90-day letter or a notice of deficiency. The IRS attorneys are very familiar, or they should be very familiar after a while, with that procedure. The importance of 6901, which will last through this case and until the statute is changed, even if the court rules for the selling shareholders on this narrow, important issue, is that 6901 provides a procedural path for the IRS, a procedural path of which they're well accustomed.
Okay, so if that's right, then the determination of transferee status for purposes of invoking this procedure drops out of the case once the IRS is in the door under 6901 and state law takes over?
Yes, and if you take a look at page 47 of the Stern opinion, the U.S. Supreme Court's opinion in Stern, as confirmed, I don't know if that's the right phraseology, as confirmed by the Fourth Circuit in Starnes, the First Circuit in Sawyer. But
well, we don't have to agree with that.
That's true. But especially Stern, page 47, what Stern says is that in looking at state law, the IRS is a regular creditor. They have no special rights. So what happens is that once 6901 is satisfied by the IRS, we say they don't here, but once 6901 is satisfied here, then the IRS has, like any other creditor, like me, like you, like the government attorney, we can use the various State Fraudulent Transfer Act sections to commence an action and to try to recover funds. Now, if I may continue with the state law test, I don't want to minimize the federal test. I might note for both the Fed, and this has been an issue of contention, surprisingly, for in interpreting both the federal test and the state test, of course, substance over form principles apply. Of course. Clearly, in the federal statute, that's been around for years, and in the state statute also. But the operational test is different. What does substance over form mean? It's different for the operational test is different for state versus federal. Let me talk about just for a moment as far as the operational test for the state law, which I believe sincerely was confirmed by your Seventh Circuit case in Boyer. Now Boyer was an Indiana case, without doubt. Wisconsin, we have Wisconsin laws. However, the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act in Wisconsin and Indiana are very, very similar. And there's a court case, a Wisconsin Supreme Court case, by the name of Badger. It's cited for different reasons, we think irrelevant reasons, by the government, but it's cited when the Wisconsin Supreme Court said, in the view of the Wisconsin Supreme Court is when applying uniform laws, in, for example, Wisconsin, they try to stay uniform with other state interpretations. So why is that relevant here? Well, your Boyer case interpreted Indiana law and mentioned the operational test as far as when substance over form principles are going to apply to recast what is admittedly a stock sale into a liquidation. It's only, Your Honors, it's the Wisconsin Transfer Act cases and the Wisconsin Dissolution Act case only apply ignoring this redemption. It only applies if this stock sale is recast into a liquidation by Woodside. Woodside and possibly dissolution based on the Wisconsin corporate law section. But as Stoyer confirms, there has to be some sort of knowledge. And there's a lot of other cases that we cite, Webolt and other cases, that for this stock sale, for the state law test to be satisfied by the IRS, again, burdens on the IRS, for the state law recast test to apply, namely for there to be a liquidation, the relevant parties, here the selling shareholders, must have actual or constructive knowledge of the scheme.
Not There's for purposes of the Fraudulent Transfer Act in
but
Wisconsin.
I agree. But for purposes of recasting, in other words, in form, we have we agree that substance applies. But in form, we have a stock sale. And if the form is going to be respected, and ignoring an alternative argument or an alternative theory raised by the Sawyer Court of Appeals, none of those three statutes apply. They only apply when there's a transfer or liquidation from the corporation, here Woodside, to the shareholders.
Right, but whether there's been a transfer for purposes of the State Fraudulent Transfer Act doesn't depend on knowledge or good faith. There's no subjective state of mind component to it.
Respectfully, we say that the Wisconsin statutes don't address when there should be a recast. What those statutes just say, if there's a transfer, insolvency, few assets to continue, whatever, those are separate tests, and some have knowledge, Your Honor, like you said, and two of the statutes don't.
Well, this is not an
don't.
Actual fraud test. This is
I
a
agree.
Constructive fraud
I agree.
Test.
So,
we're in the constructive fraud sections of the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer
yes.
Act, and there was a transfer here for purposes of the Fraudulent Transfer Act.
Humbly, no. No.
There may not have been a dissolution for purposes of the 180 claim.
Agreed.
But there was a transfer.
Humbly, respectfully, no. For the Fraudulent Transfer Act cases to be triggered, there has to be a transfer, right? Okay. There was no, in form, there was no transfer here. The transfer, the prohibited transfer, has to be between the corporation.
The Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act codifies equitable principles at common law.
I agree.
And equitable principles at common law look to substance, not form. Form matters in a whole lot of legal contexts.
But not here. Not here. Okay, so what is the operational test to apply the substance over form doctrine for Fraudulent Transfer Act purposes? Based on Webold and HBC, what it is there knowledge? Is there knowledge by the selling shareholders here of the tax scheme? I agree that under the third statute, which the IRS isn't using, that you know knowledge is important. In the two Transfer Act statutes that you're talking about, knowledge is important, is not important. But the assumption in all three of those statutes, plus this corporate law statute, is that there is, in form or substance, a transfer from the corporation to the shareholders. And it's these HBC and Webolt recast, that's the buzzwords. It's these recast cases that determine, which would, just like Boyer, which would convert what is in form a stock sale from one selling shareholder to another selling shareholder into, in substance, a liquidation of here Woodside into the selling shareholder.
Well, that's what happened here. Your clients took the assets, the cash, out of the corporation.
No,
with knowledge that this was a tax avoidance device.
Your Honor, I ask you to take a look at stipulation of facts section 95.
No, they stipulated that they didn't know the IRS was going to disallow it. That's something entirely separate. They were fully aware that this was a means of avoiding the tax liability to the corporation as a result of the asset sale. That is transparently clear from the record. And even if it weren't, we would defer to the fact-finding of the tax court, I think.
What the stipulation of fact paragraph says is that the selling shareholders knew that the tax would be reduced by taking by the corporation Woodside taking losses. Okay, that's not the test. The test is, did they know of a scheme? Did they know?
What did they know?
Pardon?
What did they know? You talk about stipulation 95.
Right.
Because I have maybe a narrower view of this, but it just seems that if that stipulation is, I understand it, they said quoted that the shareholders did not know and had no reason to know that the IRS would characterize Midcoast Offset as an abusive tax shelter and disallow the loss.
Right.
Now, does that mean they went into it thinking there was a legal method of offset where the corporation, Hollow or whatever, would continue to be tax collect or debt collection, had
right.
a bunch of bad debts that
right.
they could write off against the tax?
Right.
Now, is that what does that stipulation do for your client?
What it does is the following. One, it indicates that the clients did not know that this was a tax shelter. Frankly, the tax shelter occurred by Midcoast. And we did not, you know, the representations of Midcoast, one of the representations of Midcoast is that they were going to carry on their business. Midcoast, in 2003, which is stipulated, had a net worth of $13 to $16 million. It was an ongoing business. In other courts, you can refer to
Midcoast was, but Woodside was not.
No question about it, but I'm just answering the question about Midcoast. But the point is, Midcoast represented in one of their representations, which is in the record, that Midcoast was going to restart Woodside's business. But my personal view is what you're focusing upon is the federal test, okay? And there are two separate tests. What the state test goes to, and I think we differ right now, and hopefully we won't, is that if you take a look at these recast cases like HBC, Webolt, there's a long and uniform history of cases that the Fraudulent Transfer Act cases, when there's no in-form liquidation, you know, from the company to the shareholders, that is a stock sale, there's a uniform series of cases that say, heck with that. You can recast, but you can only recast when the selling shareholders or the relevant shareholders have knowledge of the scheme. That's what Starnes and Sawyer say. And
right, that's an intent to defraud test, and the Uniform Fraudulent Conveyance Act or Fraudulent Transfer Act as modified and the constructive fraud provisions of it do away with that.
I agree. I really would like to reserve some of my time, but I agree with that. But what I'm suggesting is these recast cases, if they don't apply, there's no transfer. That's my point. And if I may, if I could reserve the balance of my time.
Yes,
please.
You may, counsel.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court. I'm Francesca Ugolini, Counsel for the Commissioner of Internal Revenue. And first, I'd like to address your question, Judge Sykes, that you asked my opposing counsel about how we interpret Stern with respect to the relationship between the federal transferee definition in 6901H and then the state law analysis that's required under the UFTA, which is the statute upon which the Commissioner is primarily relying in this case. And the short answer is that Stern does not address the relationship between the two steps. In Stern, the court simply said that it didn't have to reach the transferee question, the federal transferee question, because there was clearly no liability under state law. The state statute provided that the widow who had received life insurance proceeds upon her husband's death could only be held liable to her husband's creditors if her husband had paid premiums on those insurance policies in fraud of his creditors. And it was undisputed there was no evidence of fraud. So the Supreme Court simply said there's clearly no liability under state law. We don't need to reach the federal transferee question. And the Supreme Court necessarily did not address the relationship between the two steps. It simply skipped the first step because there was clearly no liability under the second. I think in a case like this where transferee status is disputed and it's a threshold question, there's no reason that we need to forget the federal transferee finding once we're through the door of Section 6901. The Section 6901 and the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act, they are both remedial statutes that seek to make creditors whole, 6901 specifically the IRS, the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act with respect to creditors generally. This is about collecting unpaid debts from transferees. And just as sort of a logical matter, there's little sound basis for determining that what constitutes a transfer under federal law is not necessarily a transfer under the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act.
Well, in a lot of cases, it's going to be the same, and you won't have any controversy. In this case, the shareholders contend that it does make a difference, and that's why the structural question, if you will, matters in this case and how the steps in the analysis relate to one another. And as I understand the IRS's position, it's that this threshold question of federal law, transferee status under 6901, is more than sort of a mere procedural trigger. It actually has some substantive import for the state law question in the analysis. Is that a fair statement of your position?
Yes, to the extent that we're under the federal question, we're asking, and the dissenter in the Starnes case in the Fourth Circuit made this point, that we're looking at the threshold question, what is the transaction under review? We're seeking to collect federal taxes. And so what is the transaction under review, and who received a transfer in that transaction? And those questions are addressed under Section 6901, and it would be sort of strange to then just forget all of that, and considering that you're looking at the substance, you're looking at the economic reality, you're asking what actually happened. So to then turn to the state law question and ignore what you've determined actually happened is somewhat artificial and also in conflict with the underlying principles of the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act, which are to look at substance over form and take into account equitable principles in determining whether a creditor is entitled to have a transaction voided.
So we're essentially about the business of developing a federal common law of transferee status under 6901 in the context of these tax appeals?
Well, I think Section 6901H defines a transferee, so to the extent of a body of federal law will develop under that statute, I think that's entirely proper and not in conflict with Stern.
Or Erie.
Right. Again, Stern, the fact of the liability itself turning on state law had to do with the fact that Congress, in Section 6901, and Stern was actually dealing with a predecessor statute, 311, the Supreme Court said that Congress hasn't seen fit to put in its statute a standard for liability. And until Congress speaks otherwise, we're going to the existence and the extent of transferee liability will depend on state law.
So we determine transferee status by reference to this federal common law of transferee status under 6901 using the definition in the statute, but obviously extrapolating from there because the definition is just a laundry list. Essentially, it doesn't have a lot of content to it and doesn't stipulate a method. In other words, this substance over form test isn't in the statute. That's
correct, although the substance over form doctrine is a well-established judicial doctrine in the context of federal tax cases, and 6901 is a tax statute. So
right.
It makes sense to apply those judicial doctrines in interpreting 6901.
So once that question is answered in the affirmative, yes, this was a transfer for purposes of 6901, that determination carries over and trumps any different conclusion under state law?
We think it carries over, and that's what courts historically have done until these recent cases.
But what if there's a conflict?
If there's a conflict, I'm trying to think of a scenario where there might be a conflict, particularly if the state liability is turning on the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act, in which a transfer is defined very broadly as any transfer, direct or indirect, and it gives a laundry list. that would be a difficult case. I mean, I guess presumably if there is no liability under state law because the state does not recognize the particular transaction as constituting a transfer, it's hard for me to imagine there being a case like that. In a case like, I think that would be a difficult question.
But in this case, we have a very broad definition under the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act. And as the Wisconsin Supreme Court interprets it, there's no knowledge or good faith part of the test. So there is no conflict, as I understand what the government's position is.
That's correct. Whether one applies federal law or the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act in this case, the practical result is the same. Under either standard, there is a transfer. As Judge Sykes, as you pointed out, there doesn't need to be knowledge to have a transfer under the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act. The statutory definition is very broad. It refers to every mode of parting with an asset, direct or indirect. Knowledge was not required under this circuit's decision in the Boyer case. In the Boyer case, this court clearly stated, fraudulent conveyance doctrine is a flexible principle that looks at substance rather than form. And in looking at the transaction at issue there and characterizing that transaction for the sake of applying the UFTA, the court focused exclusively on objective economic factors.
Well, when we were talking about this, the stipulation 95, I go back to that because it does just say that you would say it doesn't matter, that the shareholders did not know and had no reason to know that the IRS would characterize Midcoast Offset as an abusive tax shelter and or disallow the loss. So you say that just doesn't matter. Must not if it is stipulation.
Right. Our primary argument is that it doesn't matter because the shareholders' knowledge does not affect the objective economic realities of the transaction.
So they could go into this with advice of counsel and accountant and everyone else saying this is a valid way to offset the tax liability. And so they risk, or whatever you want to call it, they do go along with it. It's not some devious thing. And what you're saying, they could be completely innocent of any anticipation of the IRS rejecting this?
Well, a few things, Your Honor. First of all, they would still be taking a calculated risk that the IRS would disallow the loss, and that if that happened, there would be an unpaid tax liability with the federal government holding the bag. Second, that the government has not been able to conceive of any legal way that Midcoast could have offset the taxes, and the shareholders have certainly posited none. Third, even if they really did truly believe that Midcoast had some legal way to do this, they still knew the entire purpose of the transaction was to avoid a tax, to eliminate a tax liability.
You know, tax avoidance isn't all bad. I mean, a lot of people make a lot of decisions about how it's going to impact their taxes.
That's true. And legitimate tax planning involves, and there's numerous cases to this effect, pursuing a legitimate business purpose in a way that minimizes your tax liability. But as the tax court found, that's not what happened here. The entire purpose of the stock sale with Midcoast, the shareholders had already made a decision to liquidate Woodside. They'd reduced all the assets to cash. They'd adopted a plan of liquidation. They were concerned about the tax cost of a liquidation.
Of course, it's mostly the land, and of course they've got it. It's a huge increase through inflation mostly, that the basis in their property was almost zero, so they end up with a big capital gains tax.
Right, a large taxable gain.
Yeah.
And they knew of no way to reduce that gain, and they knew that there would be two levels of tax if they pursued the liquidation. And Midcoast came along, and even if Midcoast had bona fide economic losses, the transaction still consisted of peddling those tax losses to offset a taxable gain to try to eliminate a tax liability. That was the entire purpose of the transaction.
That's Midcoast's business.
That is Midcoast's business, correct. This was not engaging in some other completely non-tax-related business transaction and doing it in a way that minimizes your taxes. This is going out and looking for a way to eliminate taxes. And that's essentially what the tax court found. The tax court found that all of the parties to this transaction knew that Midcoast, that this was Midcoast business, that they had no intention of ever paying Woodside's taxes, and that the premium, the $224,000 premium that the shareholders were getting in the transaction, was a split of the tax dollars. The entire transaction was about putting the tax money in a pot and splitting it up between the shareholders and Midcoast.
So the question then would be whether that offset had any possibility of being legitimate. And you say even if the shareholders thought it was viable or plausible or something, and you put it in worth the risk, it doesn't matter.
That's correct.
The commissioner's position in this case asks us to split with the Fourth and the First Circuit, as I understand it. I mean, your position is consistent with the dissent in the Fourth.
That's correct.
So we would be creating a circuit split if we adopted that interpretation of Stern in 6901.
That is correct. That would cause a circuit split. I think because of the factual findings in this case, I think there is a way to affirm the tax court decision purely based on the facts that does not create a circuit split. I think if you look at regardless of the extent of the shareholder's knowledge, regardless of how the transaction is characterized, what label is used, the tax court found as a factual matter that the shareholders received Woodside's money. And this was because it found that Midcoast did not contribute any real funds to the transaction. The ostensible purchase price was this $1.4 million loan from Midcoast shareholder. The tax court found that that loan, those loan proceeds went into the escrow and came out of the escrow 2 hours later with no note, no collateral, no terms, no interest charged. The tax court found as a factual matter that this loan was a recycling or a sham. So it disregarded that. And if you're disregarding Midcoast's contribution to the transaction, then the only money distributed in the transaction as a factual matter was Woodside's $1.8 million.
What, do you give any weight to this operating liability and the fact that he negotiated that between Midcoast and the shareholders?
Could you clarify which operating liability?
The personal injury.
Well, the tax court found there's evidence in the record that the shareholders were concerned about their possible liability for personal injury claims. The tax court found as a factual matter that that was not the primary motive for the transaction, that the primary motive was to eliminate the tax liability. The tax court also found that the shareholders didn't.
What if it was? What if the tax court got it wrong?
Well, I think the tax court's findings are clearly supported by the record. The evidence that the shareholders put in with respect to.
Well, it was negotiated. Midcoast didn't want to have that take on that liability, right?
Initially, Midcoast represented that it would. When it sent the letter of intent to the shareholders, there was no provision providing any coverage for these potential liability claims. The shareholders countered with a suggestion that it be capped at the amount of the premium they were going to receive from the tax elimination. And initially, Midcoast resisted. Then they had an in-person meeting in which the parties finally agreed that the shareholders' liability for any personal injury claims would be capped at this $224,000 premium.
And that was separate. That was separately escrowed? Or
well, the
set
money
aside in the escrow?
Right. Well, after the shareholders received their payment in the transaction, then they did set aside that money into a separate bank account. Ultimately, the tax court's findings, looking in hindsight, turned out to be correct. Only one claim was brought against Woodside. It was actually for an automobile accident claim, which was a partially insured claim, and the shareholders paid $50,000 on that claim.
And the insurance company paid another part, as I understand it. That was just a partial payment, as I understood it.
I'm sorry, could
that
I
That was
didn't
a partial payment, as I understood it.
That's correct. There were insurance companies that also paid out on that claim.
Now, what money was used to pay this tax they used to pay the tax, the state tax?
Midcoast, the record shows that Midcoast transferred some funds to Woodside. Of course, Midcoast withdrew all of Woodside's funds 3 days after this transaction closed. And the bank account stayed largely empty until it was the fall of 2003, so this was over a year later. Midcoast did transfer some funds to Woodside's account, and then immediately Woodside paid its Wisconsin taxes. The record doesn't disclose what the source of Midcoast's funds to Woodside are. Woodside itself didn't have enough funds to pay those taxes until Midcoast put it in.
Why did they pay those? Why didn't they just not pay those also?
The record doesn't disclose specifically why. The tax court determined that Wisconsin actually does not allow net operating losses to be carried back, unlike federal tax law. The tax court found that Midcoast likely was surprised by this and determined it had to pay state taxes.
So there wasn't a state law mechanism to apply that. They were using the I get mixed up with loss carry forwards and carry backs and all that sort of thing. But whatever it was, there was a federal law that was at least in some circumstances usable.
That's right. I think because you could, even if your carry back is bogus and eventually will be disallowed, you know, under the federal return, you can do it at least. And then there's several years before the IRS is able to catch up to that. I guess in the Wisconsin context, they couldn't even claim the net operating loss, and so you would have an unpaid tax liability on the return, which would make things happen.
I understand there are, 200 cases?
At the time that we filed this brief, there were, according to the IRS, 200 cases pending, mostly administratively, but also in the courts. There are still several of these cases in the tax courts, and also several cases in the district court that arise in a different procedural context, standard collection cases.
Are they all with Midcoast or some relation?
Midcoast is one of the predominant players. There's also an entity called Fortrend. That was the Midcoast normally handles the smaller money transactions, and then if there's much bigger money transactions, they have passed them to this entity, Fortrend, that works closely with some international banks.
So they're related then at some point?
I think they, pay referral fees to one another.
Are there any in the Court of Appeals yet?
There are two cases pending in the Ninth Circuit. They're fully briefed and haven't been argued yet. And there's one case pending in the Second Circuit that was argued in April, and the Second Circuit has not issued its decision. Unless the court has any further questions, we just ask the tax court decisions be affirmed.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Dellman, how much time? You have 2 minutes, Mr. Dellman.
Thank you very much. Your Honors, I want to have you reflect again on this quote in the Supreme Court case of Stern about just what privileges, if you will, does a federal creditor have once they satisfy the test under 6901. It is really clear based on that quote on page 47 that the IRS is just a mere regular creditor. Okay. There was a spirited discussion between Judge Black as a dissent in Stern and then the majority opinion in Stern as far as whether there was going to be a federal decisional common law on fraudulent transfers. And the decision was no, there's not. Yes, you then have a patchwork of 50 laws or whatever, but that's what the Supreme Court felt that Congress determined. With respect to this transfer again, clearly an important term. These three state statutes only apply if there is a transfer. Without a doubt, the word transfer is very broad, direct, indirect, equitable nature. Has to be, look at the substance of the transaction. All of those tests, though, depend upon there being a transfer. And if you look at these cases like Weibolt, and then the district court in Boyer, your Seventh Circuit case, if you look at HBC or HBE, it's one of those two initials, you will find that they only trigger these fraudulent state transfer cases if there is a transfer. And in all of those cases, or most of those cases, there was in form a stock sale. Now, again, I'm not running away from the fact that substance over form applies, because it does. But the test is not economic reality, like the government counsel says. It's not business purpose. It's not money cycling or anything like that. And there's not here. If I have enough time, I'll explain why. It is knowledge. Constructive, do they have reason to believe? And the government has yet to ever say in any of these cases, most importantly in this case, is that what were we to find? This is back in 2002 before everything, kind of hit the fan. Midcoast was an operating company. All of these companies were operating companies. Midcoast had a net worth of $13 to $16 million in 2002 and something like $46 million in 2003. Yes, this debt collection business was Midcoast's business. There are clearly code sections in the day that permitted the transfer of high basis assets with low value into a corporation that the client owned or that the taxpayer owned. It's code section 351 and then 362. I note quickly, those 362 was changed such that this high basis, low value capital contribution in from Midcoast into Woodside is not doable anymore. Let me talk about...
Counselor, your time has expired.
All right. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.